Have you ever heard of a cackle of hyenas?
How about an abominable sight of monks?
Or perhaps a shrewdness of apes?
Well, if you haven't, you're about to hear all about them in another Words Unraveled. Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts, a word nerd and presenter of the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books and creator of the Useless Etymology blog. And today we're exploring the world of collective nouns, also known as nouns of assembly or terms of venery.
You've already surprised me. I didn't know that terms of venery were the same thing. But what we're talking about here is a murder of crows, a murmuration of starlings, maybe even a crash of rhinos that you might have heard of. Jess, explain to us exactly what a collective noun is.
Of course, yes. So we're all familiar with terms like herds of cattle and prides of lions and even murders of crows. But we also have some more fun ones like prickle of porcupines, a flamboyance of flamingos, an ambush of tigers, an exaltation of larks, a dazzle of zebras. And these are called, as I said, nouns of assembly, collective nouns, terms of venery. And venery is a word for the sport of hunting, from the Latin venari, meaning to chase or pursue. It's also been used as a double entendre for, shall we say, more physical and romantic pursuits since the 15th century.
That's right. I actually thought I would look it up. And yeah, I did. I was confronted with a rather more sexual definition than I was expecting. And then I think, oh, you know, people talk about venereal diseases and stuff. Oh, I see. But
exactly.
Really, the origin is hunting. It's nothing to do with anything carnal.
These all came from a particular book. They're probably a lot older than most people realize. Like when I hear the term dazzle of zebras or flamboyance of flamingos, I wouldn't expect it to come from the 15th century.
Yeah, because that's the weird thing. They wouldn't have encountered, for example, leopards. And yet the writers of this specific book, which we'll get into in a second, did come up with a collective term for them. So they did know about them. I think sometimes we underestimate how much our forebears did know about the world.
I would expect there's a lot of overlap between this book, these ideas, and medieval bestiaries, because these, you know, they connected mythology and morality and ethics to different types of animals. The illustrations in those are some of my favorites, by the way. I love looking at medieval illustrations of lions in particular. They look ridiculous. They all look like weird human-faced wild cats with different pieces and manticores and all kinds of things.
So creepy. It's weird how in the past people just didn't seem to be able to draw.
I think they were hearing about lions and then interpreting them as they would. I've heard in particular, this is semi-related, but the term Cheshire cat predates Lewis Carroll, and it's from the county of Cheshire, where apparently there was either it was that there were a lot of dairies there, and they would mold the cheeses and butters and things into the shape of a cat, or there was apparently a very famous tavern there with a drawing of a very hideous and frightening looking lion on it that may have been the Cheshire cat, and it's grinning in a kind of a terrifying way. Either that or the cats there are grinning because there's so much milk everywhere.
It is a county well known for its cheeses. But let's talk about the Book of St. Albans then, which is the book that has this huge list of collective nouns in it. I counted 162 when I had a look at it, 162 different collective nouns. But it's not the only thing that's in this book, right? This book is all about how to behave, right? It's about teaching people who aren't used to upper class life how to cope in polite society.
That's right. It's also, so the full name is the Book of Hawking, Hunting, and Blazing of Arms, which also means the symbols you see on coats of arms. So it was this gentleman's handbook of hawking and hunting, and it also included pages and pages of illustrations for the symbols you would see on different family crests and on armor and elements like that. And it's it's thought to have been written by a woman, or at least in part by a woman. Juliana Berners was a nun, a dame Juliana Berners. So she was probably of, you know, higher social standing. I've read accounts that she was the daughter of a gentleman who also, you know, partook in hunting and hawking. And she clearly seems to know what she's writing about. She definitely wrote other guides to hawking in particular, other treatises on hunting and field sports, though some historians dispute whether she authored either in whole or in part the Book of St. Albans.
It's such a big deal to be writing a book in this time as well, because this particular book is thought to have been printed on something like only the third printing press in England. I mean, we're the real early days of movable type. And so it's also, you know, amazing that she was also literate to the extent that she could write this thing. What I really love about it is the fact that about half of the book is written in rhyme. So it has all these lessons on hunting and on hawking and how to behave. And it writes it all in rhyming couplets.
Are there a lot of books like this?
Yeah, well, so these are called courtesy books. And there was a real fashion for them in the late 15th century. Actually, I was having a peek around the Berlin Library trying to find out a bit more about these. And I found a passage in the Cambridge History of Early Modern English Literature that says, "The courtesy book, the unique genre so characteristic of the 16th century, also contrived to preserve the mystique of an exclusive courtly class while giving detailed instructions on how to join it." So these books are all about social mobility and teaching people how to cope in the sort of jungle that is the court.
That's amazing. It's like self-help or growth hacking of the 15th century for the upper classes.
Yeah, and these books have names like proper terms. There's another one called The Complete Gentleman, the subtitle of which is Fashioning Him Absolute in the Most Necessary and Commendable Qualities Concerning Mind or Body That May Be Required in a Noble Gentleman.
I've also run into a few on like ladies' manners and handbooks for conducting yourself well in female society.
It's all very locked in with the etiquette, right? Which is a concept that gets imported a little bit later from France, really, which is all about very intentionally having different behaviors in a courtly setting, just so that you can tell people apart, right? You can tell who's worthy of being there and who is not. It's all so deliberate and so sort of unpleasant to my mind, but it's exactly how high society worked in Spain, France, and England over the centuries after and around this book.
It's so interesting to read works from this era when it was more social standing than wealth that determined your class and rank. It was more about your birth rather than how much money you had and your name and your past, your ancestors' lands and titles.
The collective nouns, though.
Right. So this is what we're here for.
Yeah. This is the meat.
My favorite part about this is you don't think of the term like pride of lions or a litter of baby animals as being that unusual, but it is meant to be almost as whimsical and imitative of the animal's behavior as a flamboyance of flamingos, because a lion, much like in those medieval bestiaries, was connected with the virtue of pride, or rather the sin of pride, so to speak, depending on your context. And then a litter of animals is an allusion to where a dog might have puppies, for example, on, say, a straw floor. So we don't think twice about these terms, but they are meant to be as coded as these other terms in the book. And they were meant to be whimsical. Like it was supposedly a mark of your knowledge of this high etiquette based class to be able to name all of these, but they were also kind of meant to be tongue in cheek.
Yeah, I mean, surely no one was ever actually tested on these things, but the book absolutely prepares you for that eventuality that someone, that the second you're going to, you know, step into an upper class setting, they're going to start quizzing you on collective nouns. So this section of the book is called The Companies of Beasties and Fowlies. And before it, they're just talking about, you know, what you need to know in terms of, in fact, it's what we should have started by talking about here, which is when something becomes a collective noun and rather than just a plural, right? And there's this section called "An herd, a bevy, a sounder, a rout," or a root. I think it's probably pronounced rout. And it says, "My child calleth herds of hart and hind, and of buck and of doe, where you them find, and a bevy of roes, what place they be in, and a sounder ye shall of the wild swine, and a rout of wolves." Ah, they've written it with a W here, so we know how to pronounce that now.
Ooh.
"A rout of wolves, where they passing in, so shall ye him call as many as they been, right? So that talking about here about how, right, we're going to set you up now so that you know exactly which words to use and where.
It has the energy of a riddle. Like, I feel like I'm being introduced to a sphinx or something like that.
It's such a strange approach to decide to write it all in rhyme, isn't it? It's like going to see a pantomime in England where it's all just this rhyming show, and it all makes it feel very much like a sort of, I don't know, sort of in-joke.
Mm-hmm. All of these phrases and the book itself is so it's musical, it's onomatopoetic, it's almost a performance. I can imagine someone reciting segments of it or reading it aloud.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that must have been the intention, right? I mean, why else would you write it in rhyme? So what sort of things have we got in the collective nouns? I noticed looking at them that there are an awful lot of birds.
Mm-hmm.
Birds seem to take up, if not the most part, the largest part. For example, you've got a dissimulation of birds, which is just a sort of general bird. You've got a clattering of choughs, a watch of nightingales, because they just sort of sit in the tree,
mm-hmm.
whistling away, watching the people passing by. A covert of coots who do the opposite. They sort of hide away, apparently, although they always seem pretty conspicuous to me. Parliament of rooks. I could just go through all of these, you know. Gaggle of geese.
Uh-huh.
That's from the Book of St. Albans. But also the word gaggle is used in the same book to refer to ladies.
Yes, it's women. Not all animals. There's also a melody of harpers, a blast of hunters, a sentence of judges, a subtlety of sergeants, and my favorite, a superfluity of nuns, which is excellent because Juliana herself was a nun.
Yeah, and actually you get the whole holy context in which that this has been written from, that because you also have an abominable sight of monks.
It's so good. There's a lot of social commentary embedded in these.
Yeah, an impatience of wives, mm-hmm. is another one in there. A bevy of ladies. I haven't heard bevy used very much. I think the word bevy gets used a bit more your side of the Atlantic than it does my side. I've never really heard the word in the wild.
Yeah, I would say I hear that relatively frequently in business speak to some extent.
Yeah, I was once reading a script that was for my job as a journalist. It was written by an American. It referred to a bevy of laws. And I thought, a bevy? It's real. Threatening of courtiers is another one that's in there, by the way.
A threatening? Oh, no.
That's exactly what I was talking about them preparing you for the sort of jungle of courtly life.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying you've got to watch out for these people. They're out to catch you out.
If this was meant to appeal to sportsmen and hunters, then it would make sense that you get out of that nefarious environment and go into the field and enjoy yourself a little bit more.
Jess, what more do we know about the Book of St. Albans?
Some of my favorites that I have in here, I like that each of these animals, the collectives of animals in particular, seem to be a little bit either onomatopoetic or behavioral based. The two that are probably the darkest are the unkindness of ravens and the murder of crows, which are both meant to reference the idea that these two types of birds were for a long time associated with death and mortality in legends and folklore. Another one that I really like is a business of ferrets, but it's spelled with a Y, I believe, or at least it's meant to imply a busyness of ferrets. That is, the ferrets are very busy, which if you've ever seen ferrets, they absolutely are. But I also love that in Middle English, there was more of a distinction between business, as in what someone does for their living, or how they occupy their time, and busyness, the state of being busy. But I do think there's a little bit of play there because ferrets always seem to be at work.
I made a video about collective nouns a while back, and I tweeted saying that Business of Ferrets was probably my favorite of the ones we picked out. I think, yeah, a close second was Walk of Snails,
mostly because
I just couldn't understand it. But someone did reply to a tweet I said saying, oh, I love Business of Ferrets, saying, as a ferret owner, I can confirm that most ferret owners do refer to a group of ferrets as a business, even if it's just two, in which case they usually call themselves a small business owner, as a joke.
That's incredible. I love it.
That's not the only collective noun joke doing the rounds. You've probably already heard, you know, what do you call a crow sitting by itself?
Attempted murder. Uh-huh. Yeah. Perfect. I was surprised to see when I first encountered this book that flamingos were in it. I wouldn't have expected Middle English book of hunting and hawking to contain flamingos. I would have thought that perhaps they hadn't been encountered by people of England at the time. But I also like that, I love the etymology connection between flamboyance and flamingo, because both of them basically mean flaming. Mm. They come from the same root. Flamboyance at this time in the 15th century was an architectural style that echoed the shape of flames and had flame-like curves all over it. And the French, it had been introduced via French, the flamboyant means flaming or wavy. So the idea that flamingos are flame-colored birds is an interesting one, especially because at the time there wasn't as much of a distinction between red and pink. Whereas now,
really?
we look at a flamingo and we think pink, but yeah. At the time it was more considered a shade of red.
In French, it's a flamant rose, so it's a pink flamingo. They specify the color.
Yeah, and you know, I think we do say pink flamingo when referring to at least one species of flamingos.
Yeah, because they eat that sort of, I don't know, was it krill? That
I think it's shrimp.
No, I think they say it's shrimp. I don't think it's really shrimp. I don't think they're gobbling up shrimp. But I didn't know, they've got them in the south of France, where my wife is from.
And oh, wonderful. That's cool.
Yeah, it's a real surprise. I didn't realise that they got them quite so close to England, I suppose.
Well, that makes sense then, that they would have heard of it.
Yeah. So they don't have to have travelled that far. Always very beautiful. Very beautiful. Strangely randy animals.
Right. Oh, I believe it. They're very cool. I was watching a TikTok video the other day from a naturalist saying that they're able to survive in very intense environments. Like they can survive highly acidic waters and highly high temperatured waters, which most animals can't.
Why do they always have just one foot in the water? Have you noticed that? They always only have one foot in the water and the other one they've got like curled up in I don't know, not up their bum, but, you know, they stand on one leg, right?
Maybe they're just tired.
There's a reason this is not a naturalist podcast.
Stay tuned.
We should talk about some unofficial ones. Mm-hmm. By unofficial, I mean the ones that don't appear in these courtesy books, mm-hmm. but have sort of caught on a little bit, or at least sort of folkloric. Because interesting thing is that a lot of the ones that we're talking about now disappeared. In fact, almost all of them disappeared, but a few of them, like A Murder of Crows, were resurrected in the 20th and 19th centuries, right? During other periods where it was becoming fashionable to do what we're doing now,
right?
Which was to talk about quirky old collective nouns, but they sort of took hold. And so that's why we still have, talk about a parliament of owls sometimes, or a murmuration of... Is it starlings?
Starlings, mm-hmm, that's
starlings.
Right. Or a sleuth of bears.
I hadn't heard sleuth of bears, but that's in the Book of St. Albans, but I hadn't heard that in the wild. Yeah.
I had heard it mostly in association with other terms. Like, I don't think that many people say it that frequently, but maybe also because I've always lived in an area with a good deal of bears. So perhaps there's a bear in my neighborhood, for example, not necessarily a sleuth. I've only seen the one, but
goodness me,
it's a black bear. They're basically giant raccoons. I looked this one up because, sleuth is usually associated with like a detective, detective fiction. But this is a different sense of sleuth, both of them from the same source, but in the 12th century, sleuth or even sloth, unrelated to the other kind of sloth, meant to track or trail a person. So a bear would be something that tracks or trails, or something that you might trail after as a hunter.
Yeah. So if you are a sort of sleuthing detective, I suppose you are on the trail of a criminal or a murderer or something, right?
Exactly. Apparently, sleuth was also in the 1800s used as a word for a bloodhound, like a sleuthhound was a bloodhound.
I actually prefer that to bloodhound. I like sleuthhound.
Yeah, bloodhound is a little terrifying. It's a bit of a harrowing word.
For such an adorable doggy.
They're so floppy.
Yeah, so floppy. The floppiest of dogs. So have you ever heard, for example, talking about ones that, you know, sort of caught on but aren't, yeah, they're not among the originals, as far as I know. A Shiver of Sharks.
Ooh, I like that one. That would make sense why that wouldn't be in the book, because at the time, shark was a word for a person, not an animal.
What?
The word shark was originally a word for like a bad person, like you know, we use the term card shark or card sharp, a lone shark. That's the original sense of the word shark, and it wasn't extended to the animal until later as a comparison to bad people.
Wow.
At the time, sharks were more commonly called, like, they weren't all necessarily called the same species because there wasn't as much of a study of, like, the different biological connections of different kinds of sharks. So they had different names like dogfish and things like that, which also appear today for particular species of sharks.
I was looking up naval slang a few months ago, and I came across one bit of naval slang, which is a term for a shark, which was water lawyer.
Oh, I love it. That's fantastic. Which also makes sense.
Yeah, it does, isn't it? Because you could just, well, actually, I shouldn't say this, my sister is a lawyer, and if she ever hears me referring to her as a shark,
hear that association throughout history. But yes, in the 1400s, it was a word for a scoundrel or a villain or a swindler, and it's probably from a German word for a villain, wow. And then it wasn't extended to sharks until the 16th century, I believe. Might have to fact check that one.
That's wonderful, though. I didn't know. I just thought it had always applied to, you know, a pointy fish.
Yeah, that's one of the more mind-bending etymology facts I've come across.
What about a crash of rhinos?
That's fun. I like that. It's appropriate. I feel like we could come up with some like more entertaining ones of those. I feel like a rumble of rhinos could be good too.
Yeah, a crash of rhinos. But it's real. It gets used. I sort of mentioned this as a throwaway once, and then someone from Namibia put me straight, saying, "No, here we sometimes call them a crash of rhinos." Okay, all right, fine. I like the idea of a huddle of walruses, which is another one. Walruses can also come in a gang. And rumber of rattlesnakes is obviously very elegant.
I like it. I've heard of a quiver of cobras.
Ooh.
That one's nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that makes me think of like a quiver of arrows. Like you could be just have sort of a tube full of snakes on your back and you could just, you know, pull one out and say, glaring of cats.
Ooh.
That's an interesting one. Yeah,
I think that says a lot about the coiner's relationship with cats. Maybe not fans.
Yeah, indeed. And you know that not actual, because I don't know how much you can call any of these things actual. I mean, that they're words; they're invented hundreds of years ago, so they're as actual as many other words, right? I mean, someone's got to come up with these things, but I don't know. They just feel so synthetic, don't they? But the one for cats from the Courtesy Books was clowder.
Oh, I like that one.
Cats, which is just a variation on the word clutter.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I've heard of a parade of elephants too, which I think is probably cultural, has to do with elephants as performers.
Well, they walk in a line, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Elephants. So perhaps more of that.
I hadn't read the sort of oppressive subtext to that one.
Maybe more in the vein of like Rudyard Kipling with his like military elephants in the Jungle Book.
Then there are sort of standard collective terms, aren't there, that we use, like flock, for example, which can be you can have a flock of sheep, you can have a flock of goats, you can have a flock of birds, obviously, and you can have a flock of Christians as well.
Jesus.
Flock. Do you know where the word flock comes from?
No, I don't. Tell me.
It's from Old English. It's a very, very old word, and it was flock in Old English, flocc instead. But it's perhaps from Old Norse, flocker is a word that appears. So a term that was used by the Vikings that they would have brought over to England along with, you know, aggression.
Of course.
And it's one of the words that they've given us. Swarm is another old English word as well. You can trace that way back. There's variants of it in almost all of the Germanic languages, but we don't actually know what it originally refers to, whether or not it refers to the movement of the swarm. So if that's the case, it means it's related to the word swerve, or whether, I don't know, it's something a bit more to do with the sound.
Maybe more onomatopoetic or imitative. Yeah. That would make sense.
Yeah, but but how? That's what I don't get about that theory. I mean, it doesn't, bees don't sound like a do that. I suppose as they sort of undulate in and out.
I could imagine the word swarm being pronounced in the voice of a swarm of bees. So like swarm. So tell me, what collective nouns would you use for your occupations and hobbies? Like I could see us being an elocution of etymologists, for instance.
Oh, I do like that one. A subscription of YouTubers.
Oh, very nice. Maybe. I like that
perhaps
one.
An oversubscription.
A block of writers, perhaps.
Oh, well, now that's very good.
I like
that's
that one.
That should actually be it if it isn't already, for sure. Perhaps people can get in touch if they've got any collective nouns that they'd like to use in their professions too. What do you and your colleagues call yourselves at home?
Let's close out by naming just a few more we haven't discussed yet, whether they're official from the Book of St. Albans or not, just some entertaining ones that people might be able to use in the future. I particularly like a wisdom of wombats.
Oh, I like that. They do seem kind of wise, don't they? Sort of mm-hmm. ponderous, the wombat. I don't know if I like this one. It makes me chuckle just because it makes me think of the sort of what led them to coin this one. But in the Book of St. Albans, it talks about a drunk ship of cobblers.
That's fascinating. I wonder what does drunk ship mean alone?
It must just mean, they put ship at the end of anything, right? Just to refer to sort of, it's like a ness.
Oh, I see. Like a relationship
yes,
kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're obviously gathering, getting drunk together and making shoddy shoes. Shoddy. That's an interesting word. I learned where that came from the other day. Do you want to know? Shoddy is it's offcuts of cloth that are reworked into a new bit of cloth. But it's a term from weaving.
Like a little amount that's been like shed, perhaps. Maybe it's a variation on that. That's interesting.
Oh yeah, good shout. Yeah, I bet it is. Yeah. Any more for any more?
I particularly enjoy, I don't know how official this one but I've seen it in several places, a bouquet of pheasants, an ostentation of peacocks. We mentioned a parliament of owls. That's one of my favorites. And then a tittering of magpies.
Why did that one make me titter in itself? A tittering of robs. Wonderful. I would encourage anyone to go online and look up the Book of St. Albans and look up the companies of beasties and fowlies and work your way through the 162 of them. It's pretty difficult to read, isn't it, Jess? Because there's no standardized spelling at this point. And also the way that some of the letters are written are really, really strange. Like a W looks a lot like a B. It took me ages to work out the walk of snails, which is clearly highly ironic, by the way. But absolutely have a look. Book of St. Albans.
That reminds me, we talked about a business of ferrets. They're also sometimes called a pheasanting of ferrets. And it's because in the Book of St. Albans, the word business looks like it's spelled like pheasanting.
Oh, that's amazing, isn't it? They wouldn't have been used to the type, right?
Because
nothing has been printed on a printing press like this before. Amazing. This has been a great subject to look into, Jess. I've really enjoyed it.
It's one of my favorites. I'm so glad we got to talk about it.
Collective endorsement of collective nouns from us. Thanks a lot for watching or listening to this edition of Words Unraveled.
See you next time.